Chapter 4. Conflicts with Mom. I expect all children with ADHD try their parents' patience. We are forgetful. We might mean well, but we lose track of what they asked us to do. We find it hard to switch tasks when doing something we enjoy. Clean up your room. Put your things away. Stop petting the dog when I'm talking to you. I told you an hour ago it was time for bed. Do I have to supervise your every move? Other times, we cannot get ourselves to do what our parents want. We avoid tasks that sound boring or hard to perform. Do I have to do that? Please give me something else to do. Or we start the task and get distracted by something along the way. Okay, today I'm going to surprise Mom. I'll clean up my room without her even asking. But what's this? This comic book I lost last week. The next thing we know, we are engrossed in reading the comic book, completely forgetting the messy room and our vow to clean it up. Kids with ADHD have trouble being punctual. How often have I told you we must leave by 8 a.m. to get you to school on time? Do we have to have this argument every morning? Mom, I'm ready. But you haven't combed your hair or put your homework in your backpack. Did you remember your lunch? I swear you'd wear out the patience of a saint. Not only that, we are argumentative, frequently seeing only our side of a situation, and we are reluctant to give up. We think of one reason after another for why our position is the right one. The parent calls and says, "It's time for you to come home." The child responds, "Why can't I stay longer? I'm having fun. It's almost supper time. Last night we didn't eat until 7, 30 minutes from now. I can stay for 30 minutes and still get home in time for supper." Stop arguing with me. I want you home right now. It's your turn to set the table. What about this? I come home in 20 minutes. That leaves enough time to set the table. You wear me out. Why does it always have to be like this? You can stay, but I say this against my better judgment. Part of me knows your 20 minutes will be longer than that, but I'm warning you, if you don't come home in time to set the table, you'll be grounded tomorrow. I have two vivid memories of such interactions with my mother related to my ADHD traits of being stubborn and argumentative. Once she bought me the latest style blouse from a store in Boston, a blue and white blouse with roll-up sleeves. Under different circumstances, I would have liked the blouse, but because my mother bought it for me, I did not want it. I didn't try it on and handed it back to her, saying, "I don't like it. Why did you buy it for me? It looks stupid and I won't wear it." Not graciously accepting my mother's present was typical of my combative relationship with her. She took the blouse, abruptly turned, and left the room without another word. Another time, as a teenager, I talked back to my mother. I stood facing her in the front hall at the bottom of the stairs. I was 14, and at 5'7", we were the same height. I was overwrought and spoke aggressively, spitting the words out. "Why are you always interfering in my life? I never get to do things the way I want. I hate living in this family." "I have to do what I think is best," she replied wearily, worn down by our history. "Sometimes you do things or want to do things that aren't appropriate. Just because your older sister does something doesn't mean it's the right thing for you to do. It's no fun having a battle of words time and time again." "That's what you always say," I shot back. "You never listen to me, to what I want. All I hear is, you can't do this, you can't do that. I'm so sick of it. Why can't you be a better mother?" The moment I spoke those words, she slapped me hard on the left cheek. She had never done that. I pushed her too far. My eyes got wide and my jaw dropped. She stared at her upturned hand, stunned by what she had done. We stood there for a moment, not knowing what to do or say. I put my hand to my cheek and walked away with my head down and my shoulders slumped. I didn't want her to see I was crying. After outgrowing adolescence, I developed an affectionate relationship with my mother. Sometimes I went home for the weekend from college and occasionally brought a boyfriend. She waited for our arrival by the open front door, quickly engaged the new arrival in conversation, and invited him into the kitchen for a just-out-of-the-oven treat. After I married Steve and moved to Seattle, I maintained close relations with my parents. I wrote, called, and had them join us on family vacations. My mother stayed with us for several weeks after the birth of each of my children. She said it was time to depart for home when I complained about how she did things. When worn out from childbirth, I appreciated everything she did. But I wanted to do things my way as I got my strength back. If she moved the water glasses to a more convenient place in the cupboard, I asked why she moved them instead of acknowledging her brilliant decision. When I stopped being complimentary and appreciative, she left for home. Perhaps my adventuresome spirit comes from my mother. She wanted my father to go with us on family trips, but if he was unwilling to leave work, she took us without him. With four children, ages 12, 10, 8, and 5, she drove her station wagon from Fitchburg, Massachusetts to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, an 800-mile round trip to visit her family and my father's family. We children didn't have iPhones or tablets to keep us entertained during the endless drive, but we amused ourselves by keeping track of which state license plates we saw and playing the memory game of I packed my bag and in it I put. My father's mother still lived in the house where my father was born. Although it had electricity, gaslight fixtures remained in the hallways. Grandma Herb wore old ladies' clothes with black, lace-up, thick-heeled shoes. On one trip to Pennsylvania, I got German measles and had to stay in a dark room and wear sunglasses until I recovered. Doctors at the time commonly believed that exposure to light when you had measles would make you lose your eyesight. Being confined to my room felt like the worst possible punishment. My mother never attended college, but she was comfortable talking with anyone. Every time she visited us in Washington State, she arrived with tales from her seatmate on the plane that she talked with the entire flight. She was comfortable with herself and at ease with everyone. Even as a child, I thought my mother was special. She was not exceptionally tall, but when we shopped in crowded Filene's bargain basement and were separated, I could always locate her. To me, she always stood out. I wanted to be an excellent student, but was never in the top group. My report cards were usually all B's, with the errant A in physical education. I could not think of myself as intelligent because of all my stupid actions. During high school, I was put in a special study hall in the library with just one other student because we were the troublemakers in the regular study hall. The guidance counselor, whose office adjoined the library, supervised us, although he was often elsewhere in the building. One day, when he was out of his office, we snuck in and looked through his files. I found out my IQ was 135. Although I have little faith in IQ tests now, back then, my IQ sustained me. Despite some of my unacceptable and foolish behaviors, I was smart. In my senior year, I applied to three colleges: the University of Massachusetts, where I was confident of admission; Mount Holyoke, one of the highly selective Seven Sisters colleges; and Wheaton College, one of the seven less selective Little Sisters colleges. The admissions person at Mount Holyoke asked me why my score was 490 on my English SATs in my junior year and 650 in my senior year. She wondered if I was sick on the day with the lower score. I had no explanation, but variable performance without knowing why is a characteristic of ADHD. Perhaps I was less stressed the second time taking the test because I knew what to expect. I didn't understand then that my brain worked well in the right conditions and did not work well when I was stressed or distracted. I went to Wheaton, not Mount Holyoke, not realizing it was a poor choice for a person with ADHD who thrives on novelty and adventure. Individuals with this disorder love stimulation and variety. It gets our adrenaline going, and adrenaline wakes up our brains. Boredom is intolerable. Something boring never wakes up our brains. Being a student at Wheaton College in the village of Norton, Massachusetts, was boring. The college of 800 women emptied on the weekends as they headed for various men's colleges, many as far away as a 6-hour drive. That is how desperate we were to get away. During the summer vacation after my first year of college, I worked as a server in an oceanfront hotel in New Jersey. Bob, a busboy from Colgate College, and I started dating, so when I returned to Wheaton in the fall, I joined the women making the 6-hour drive to Colgate. I also met my future husband, Steve, working at my summer job. He was a student at Brown University, only 45 minutes from Wheaton. If I spent the weekend on campus, I had few options for entertainment. I could study, play tennis or swim, and hang out in the smoker, a place on campus where students smoked, entertained visitors, and played pool. I could also walk the half mile to the local grocery store with a cafeteria counter. How I recall the long, lonely weekends spent at Wheaton College. During my sophomore year, I roomed by myself and had few friends. I learned the difference between being alone and being lonely. I never felt lonely if something engaged my mind. After graduating from college with a major in economics, I worked for a year in the trust department of a bank in Boston. I started dating Steve, who now was a 6-hour bus trip away in medical school in Montreal, Canada. I hated the work in the bank, but was afraid to leave, as it had been difficult for me to get a job. I was thankful when, a year later, I found a job teaching emotionally disturbed blind children. This job persuaded me to become a social worker, and I started my studies at the School of Social Work at Boston University. On March 1, 1969, during my first year as a student, Steve and I married. In June, we moved to Seattle, and I completed my second year of graduate school at the University of Washington. Since I received a government grant to work with the elderly, I trained as a geriatric social worker and continued my track record as an average student. I worked for a few years before staying home to raise our 3 sons. I served as co-president of the Pierce County League of Women Voters during that time. When my youngest son started school, I returned to work as a discharge planner 3 days a week at Tacoma General Hospital. Later still, I became a social worker at the Toby Jones Retirement Community in Tacoma. Shortly before graduating high school, I remember thinking, I will do something remarkable with my life. After my diagnosis, I read that most adults with ADHD have unrealistic self-images. We are doubly wounded when we are diagnosed. We have a disorder, and we realize we are not as special as we thought. We recall when we were sure we were right and everyone else was wrong. We remember when we were positive something was important and now realize it was not. After diagnosis and treatment, we reflect on our earlier behaviors with insight and shame, recognizing how inappropriate we often were. Long before my diagnosis, I lost my belief that I was remarkable. I didn't know what caused my humbling experiences, but they slowly undermined any lofty vision I had for my life. It would be many years before I rekindled my aspiration to do something meaningful with my life. As of 2022, 2.5% of the world's population is about 200 million. An estimated 8.4% of children and 2.5% of adults in the world have ADHD.